helicopters are significantly more complicated to fly than an airplane. And I would argue that there's nothing like the sense of freedom when you're flying in a helicopter that you could go anywhere. So when I was 16, I flew a helicopter and I landed it on my grandparents' front lawn. It was funny because then there was some media there, and the media, I thought it was like the coolest thing, because I like helicopters are amazing. But the media did an interview, and the commentators were talking afterwards, and they're like, imagine that, flying helicopters and still wearing braces.
Hi, welcome to the Growth Mixtape Podcast, and I'm your host, Bob Mathers. We have one rule here. We're going to chase our curiosity way outside our comfort zones. The more uncomfortable and awkward, the better. We're going to talk to people you've never heard of doing jobs you didn't know existed. We're going to hear human stories about the things that connect us, what we can learn from one another, and what we can take away to apply to our own lives. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs on a mixtape, you create something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Dr. Suzanne Kearns, a pilot, professor, and visionary in the future of aviation. Now, I've got to admit, this might be the hardest intro I've ever had to write. My job is to give you two or three reasons to keep listening, and no matter what I do, I can't get it down to less than 10. Suzanne's story is incredible. She started flying at 15, soloed on her 16th birthday, and was flying helicopters before she had a driver's license. She shares what it's like to be a woman in an industry where still only 5% of pilots are women. We talk about the collective trauma that the aviation community suffered when the entire industry shut down over the pandemic, and how it sparked a global conversation around sustainability for one of the most unsustainable industries on the planet. Suzanne's passion for inspiring new generations of pilots is intoxicating. She talks about how jetpacks and electric planes are not all they're cracked up to be, but how electric air taxis like in the Jetsons are closer than you think. I cannot get enough of this conversation or of Suzanne. Please enjoy Suzanne Kearns. Suzanne Kearns, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, yeah. So I thought to kick us off, I thought I'd share a quick story about how we met and how we came here. We were at an event, and admittedly, I had never heard of you. And you were talking about a topic that I knew, without exaggeration, absolutely nothing about. And this idea of aviation, the evolution of the industry, it touches on sustainability and a lot of really interesting stories. And what I found was that I was captivated, and it really exposed me to a topic that, like I said, I knew nothing about, but actually turns out it has tentacles into all different parts of my life. And since I've heard you talk, I've found this conversation coming up over and over again. And I don't know whether I've manifested that somehow or whether I just was unaware of it. So I'm really excited to dig into this because I have so many questions.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm excited to talk with you. And aviation is one of my favorite things to talk about, but it is undeniably facing huge challenges and all sorts of different evolutions of technology and people and how people travel that poses both threats and opportunities. So it's a whole new world out there.
No kidding. Well, before we get too far into that, one of the things I remember about your story is how you got interested in aviation at such an early age. So I'd love if you could share more about that.
For sure. So I grew up in Wyarton, Ontario. Most people here would probably know it as the groundhog capital of Canada. We have an albino groundhog that predicts the weather that's coming up, which is very exciting. But growing up in a small town, what Wyarton has, which is interesting, is a really big airport. And my family home was under the circuit path of that airport. And it's a huge attractor for a lot of people who own their own aircraft and fly for fun. So there was sort of this common theme where there was always these small airplanes circling overhead during my childhood. So I went to my parents as a young teenager and I said, you know, hey, I want to do that one day. That's going to be me one day. And I think I wore them down over time. And eventually, they signed me up for flight training when I was 15. So I started studying, and you know, I was the super nerd kid in high school where I'd spend my recesses in the library doing flight plans because this was like, you know, everything in the world. I thought it was the coolest thing. And so I started flying when I was 15. I soloed on my 16th birthday, which is the youngest you can be to do that. And then I finished all my airplane training, and I wasn't yet 17, which at that point was the limit to get your license. So I ended up moving to Toronto, and I lived out of a hangar while I was 16, and I learned how to fly helicopters over the summer. So I would fly helicopters, and then young drivers would come pick me up and take me for a driving lesson because I didn't have my driver's license yet. And so on my 17th birthday, I had both my airplane and fixed wing licenses. And that sort of was the beginning of my journey. And I think it's something that's very true for a lot of aviation people, that aviation becomes a part of your identity. It's your passion. It's not just a job. It really does become part of who you are.
So you were flying helicopters before you drove a car?
Well, I was learning to drive a car. Yes, I was learning both at the same time.
Yeah, I remember thinking about you telling that story and imagining what it would be like if my kids came to me and wanted to start flying and go to flight training at 15. And I'd like to believe I would be supportive. I'd like to believe I would be the kind of parent that allowed them to chase their dreams in that way. I'm not 100% sure about that.
Well, now I'm a mom of three teenagers, and I can say as well, sometimes I question my parents' decisions. But there was one time my mom was driving, because there's a road right by the Wyarton Airport that if you're approaching on one of the runways, you kind of approach low over the road. And so I remember getting a call after I had done some flying, and she's like, I was driving to work and I saw your plane and it seemed way too close to the ground and I don't think you're doing it. And I'm like, nope, that's okay. Everything's all right. So there was a little bit of that, but no, they were wonderfully supportive. And it is an interesting parallel though, that I think the world has changed. And despite my efforts, none of my kids are aviation lovers like I am. In my house, it's like a nerdy mom thing. Like, which I tell them, I'm like, other people think this is very cool. I'm like, sure, mom. Okay. So it's a bit of a different household.
Well, they would be in such a privileged position, because I've often sat in a plane, usually like we're sitting there and waiting to take off. And I've often thought I'd love to be with a pilot to tell me what the hell is going on. Like, what are all these bings and bongs and these sounds that we hear every time? And what does cross-check mean? And there's just a million different things happening and a million different things that have to go right in order for this whole thing to work out. And it's just a mystery to most people. And yet your kids could sit there, and maybe they've never asked you because nerdy mom, they're just not that interested. But I'm like, God, I would love to go traveling with Suzanne sometime and just like walk me through what's happening.
Well, yeah, I think it's fascinating too. And part of my role as a scholar now, as a professor, is to study not just what it means to have a human being in the center of this very complex, dynamic, you know, rapidly technologically evolving system, but also the idea that the pilot in that airplane is just one of thousands and thousands of components that all have to work in a coordinated fashion in order to achieve aviation. And it's not just the technology or the aircraft, but even think about things like international regulations, right? The world has agreed that that every country has sovereign control over the airspace over their country, which is similar or if you think about it as a parallel, where we have international waters where nobody owns that part of the ocean, it's open. So that was, it's an interesting thing, because I always tell my students how important it is that all the countries in the world agree to the same set of regulations and rules. And imagine how hard that is and how much coordination that takes, but how essential it is. Otherwise, every time an airplane crossed over to another country's airspace, there'd be a whole new set of rules. And so even regulations, which I think a lot of aviation folks would say is not the most fun part of the industry, it's fascinating when you think about this rich fabric of all of these things having to come together at the same time.
Yeah, the complexity of everything that has to happen. And like I said, the million things that have to go right in order for the millions of planes that are traveling around the world every day to take off and land successfully with all these people on them that are just oblivious to everything that's happening around them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about how you got into being a professor, because that happened pretty early too, right?
Yeah, so When I was in high school, so I had finished all of my fixed wing training, and then I went to a 1-year helicopter pilot program at Conestoga College up in North Bay. So it was a 1-year program. We learned to fly a few different kinds of helicopters, and we even had like our chainsaw operator certificate so we could cut down trees and build landing pads for the helicopters. And then at the end of that journey, I had sent my resume to every helicopter company in Canada, and I now use this as a story of what not to do with my student pilots, because it was like on blue paper with clouds on it, which is now very embarrassing. And I know those resumes go right in the garbage can. But I didn't get a job. And I think it was the resume, but also because there's a bit of a history in Canada where first jobs for pilots are usually in the north. It's one of the entry pathways. And for helicopters, a lot of those resource-related jobs, they don't have separate facilities for men and women. So it means that it's quite challenging for a young woman to get that foot in the door. So I ended up at that point, there were no university degree programs in pilot training in Canada. So I went to a school in the States. It's called Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. And it's a university that's literally attached to the airport, and everybody's a pilot on campus. And you go from like thinking you're kind of special because you're the pilot and your friends. And then you're like, oh, every single one of my friends is a pilot. But it's a whole different world because it's about, 25 men to every woman on the entire campus, very, very few women. And then I finished my bachelor's, and I thought I wanted to be a professional pilot. And I was interning at that point with an airline, so I was riding the jump seat and traveling every weekend. And then a few different things happened. I was living that lifestyle, and I found I didn't love the disconnect of being away from home as much as I thought I would. I was having some issues with some inappropriate interactions with some staff in the airline. And then a colleague of mine, another student, was killed in a training accident. And then all of those things at the same time was sort of this epiphany for me. And it was this question of, I love aviation, but maybe there's something else I can do to support this industry and the sector. So I went back and I got my master's in human factors, which is kind of the science of how your mind and your body work. I explain it to my students as sort of the science of why people make mistakes and understanding that so we can try to avoid that. And I came back to Canada, and I found that while I was out of the country, the University of Western Ontario had started the first degree-based aviation program. And so I applied, and they hired me there when I was 24 as an aviation professor, and I've been doing this for 20 years. I moved to Waterloo about 8 years ago, and I think I got the best job in the world because I teach these young, passionate student pilots. Like they're like me in a lot of ways, that aviation is a part of who they are, and it's their hobby, and they fly flight simulator on the weekend, and they watch every Mayday episode. This is a real passion field, and so teaching the next generation is a real privilege.
I can't wait to get into that. Before we do that, I can't imagine what it's like. You're from small town Ontario, and when you get introduced, people are like, oh, this is Suzanne, she's a pilot. You're like, you said, you're like the special one of one. That's kind of part of your identity. Then you go and you're a part of this community where everybody is the most special person from their small town. Mm-hmm. And you're one of 25, you're a woman in a sea of men. Like, how would you describe that experience?
It is an evolution. And so you have to relearn how social dynamics work. Every classroom I would sit in during that experience, after about first year, I was the only woman in the entire classroom. and so you kind of stand out, you question your role, you seek out mentors, and you seek out others who may look like you, who have succeeded. Several years later, I had an experience where when I was a young professor, I went to a conference, and same thing, the professional conferences were all like that. Like it was all men, all the panels were all men, there were very few women. And I remember the first time I saw a woman on stage speaking as sort of an aviation leader, and I was so excited. And so after the session, I approached her and I said, oh, I'm so excited to see a woman on the panel. This is really, really cool. Do you have any advice for me? Because I'm still new. And she had said, there are only two types of women in aviation. You can either be a a B word or a doormat. And she's like, and nobody's ever called me a doormat. And then she walked away. I was like, oh my gosh, like, are these are the two options that I have? Because between those two categories, like I have more of a gentle personality. Like I was like, is that the only path I have? And so that was a real, I guess, an interesting insight, but it stuck with me for so long. And it took me, you know, now I've been doing this for 20 years. And I would tell the young women coming up behind me to say that it's possible to be a leader and to have impact by leveraging the strengths of who you are. And so just because those who came before you, maybe they epitomized certain personality characteristics or attributes that you wouldn't see alignment with, that you don't have to change or compromise who you are to find success. Like you can create your own path that's true to who you are. But it's tricky when you're young and you have, you know, these big questions about what your role would look like.
I love that story. I just imagine you standing at the side of the stage all excited, and then she walks away and you're like, okay, I guess we're not going to be best friends. Like,
I remember calling my husband like, oh no, I think I'm a doormat. I'm so concerned. What does this mean? Yeah, that stuck with me for way too long.
So you talked about, yeah, that gender disparity. So have you seen them? So you were a professor, what, at 24?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you seen the makeup of your classes change over time?
We've always seen, and there's research around this as well, that there's a higher proportion of women that join university-based pilot programs versus just, because you don't have to get a degree to be a pilot. You can go to the airport and flight train directly. But we see that there's always a higher percentage of women and people from other backgrounds in the university systems. And so we see, like, I think maybe when I started, it was, you know, 15%. And now we're maybe in my class, maybe 30% women are sort of in that range, which is much higher, because if you look at the airline pilots around the world, only about 5% are women.
And why do you think that is?
That's a hard question that nobody has a good answer to. I think, you know, we often in aviation look at other fields. Like there was a time medicine and law, for example, were not very open to women being involved, but they've made tremendous strides forward and they've sort of equaled out that imbalance. But aviation has been a really hard parallel. And I've heard stories sometimes, like, for example, I have friends who are airline pilots and they will have maybe a passenger question if they can be a mom and be an airline pilot because of the travel involved. And there's an interesting discussion there because people don't often challenge the flight attendants. Like, can you be a flight attendant and a good mom, even though the flight attendants have the same travel schedule as the pilots? And so you wonder, like, well, is it really about the travel or is it about the leadership role and that authority role? And I don't know. And then none of the research has shown, and there's research that, you know, compares men and women and their performance as pilots, and there's nothing showing women perform more poorly, but there is research suggesting that people don't respond as well to women in that role.
Man, that's fascinating. Yeah. So I want to get to the sustainability, because I'm wondering how you, again, this is probably the part of your talk that I had never thought about. And I'm guessing too that sustainability wasn't a part of the conversation when you were starting out in aviation. So how did it evolve and become a big part of what you do?
Yeah, I can say with certainty that I went to one of the best aeronautical universities internationally, and the environmental impacts of aviation wasn't part of the curriculum. But just before the pandemic, I had a really striking experience where I teach a really big first-year class, about 200 students, and I had a group of them kind of reluctantly come to the front of the room after a lecture, and they're very identifiable on campus. My students, they're, you know, they're wearing pilot uniforms often on campus, or they have their aviation hoodies, and they had come to the front of the room and said other students on campus had called them out in sort of the cafeteria and said, why would you want to be a part of aviation? Why would you want to be a part of an industry that is contributing to climate change? You should be embarrassed. And it struck them so deeply. And it struck me so deeply because I've been in the aviation world my whole career, and no one had ever asked me that question before, that it really was sort of this next generation who was challenging, can you love aviation and the planet at the same time? And when they asked me that question, I always sort of had the same response, which is that, you know, we can be really proud of the good that aviation does in the world. Like, I think if you rank the economic impact of aviation relative to the countries, we would be roughly equivalent to like the 26th largest country in the world. Like, we have massive economic impact, employment impacts, and cultural impacts. Like, aviation really does bring the global community together in a way that wouldn't be possible otherwise. But the reality is that for us to have a balanced perspective of the future, we also need to have our eyes wide open and be completely transparent to recognize the negative environmental impacts of our sector. And so that's kind of the message I had given them, is that, you know, you should be proud of the good, but you can only really be proud of the good if you're also doing everything you can to work towards reducing and eliminating the harm and the negative. And that's really what sustainability is. That sustainability is about optimizing the good and working to reduce and eliminate the harm.
Hey, it's Bob, and I'm taking the Growth Mixtape on the road in a series of keynote speeches inspired by the stories of my amazing guests. At their core, these signature talks are about how to get you and your teams off autopilot and stop settling for small incremental improvements. This isn't going to come from spewing business advice. My podcast is full of people that have done incredible things, and every one of them struggles with self-doubt, imposter syndrome, and the crippling fear of judgment that holds so many of us back. They've also found ways through it by rediscovering their creativity, their curiosity, and the confidence to do scary things. Imagine the power of bringing these vulnerable stories to life, live and on stage, to help you and your teams hit your targets, find your voice, and be the rock stars you are. Book me for your next event at bobmathers.ca. Now back to the show. It's so interesting. I think the part of that that resonated with me, I guess, personally, was that sustainability is this interesting thing. You know, I care about the planet. I care about the world that I'm leaving to my kids. But I like travel, and I've got things that I want to do. And it's never occurred to me that I might make trade-offs, or I should be thinking about those two things together. And I don't know, how do you think about that? Because that's not something that, you know, it comes down to this conflict. How much are you willing to change for the things that you say are important?
Yeah, well, I think I would agree with you that is sort of the position I was in as well. I'm like, aviation is a source of inspiration for the world. And, you know, it's this amazing community of people that I care about. And it's like over and over and over again in my life, it had been reinforced that this is, you know, a passionate, innovative, creative community of people who love aviation. And facing that stark reality that there is a negative impact of the sector is very hard, specifically for aviation people. And so when you're talking about the impacts, like what we saw is the rise of the flight shaming movement. And there's some really creative billboards that have been put up around Europe, strong marketing campaigns, you know, really calling out the industry for greenwashing, you know, saying that they're doing something for the environment, but in reality, not acknowledging those impacts. Or, you know, things like advertising something like maybe they got rid of single-use plastics, but they're not considering that they haven't met any of their emission reduction goals. So you know, really highlighting one element, but not being transparent about talking about the other. And so for myself, I never studied sustainability or environmental protection, but it struck me that the long-term viability of this sector that I care about is in question. And so I started asking myself during the pandemic, you know, really hard questions, but what are the biggest challenges facing the future viability of our industry? And that's really what sustainability is. People think of sustainability, and I did previously as well, only in terms of the environmental impacts. But sustainability means the ability to sustain. It's the ability to meet our needs today while not sacrificing or compromising future generations' ability to meet their needs. So literally to sustain the activities that we're doing. And that's why when you think of sustainability, it's about the environmental impacts, but it's not the environmental impacts while sacrificing the economic viability of the sector, nor the people in the workforce in the sector. And the way that I often explain this to my students is like, imagine tomorrow we had a perfectly net zero aircraft, like someone waved a magic wand and we have this new plane that will take you across the ocean and produce zero emissions. But if it is so expensive that nobody can afford it, that companies can't find profitability in operating it, and we don't have any pilots or maintenance engineers or air traffic controllers or airport staff to sustain that infrastructure for that new technology, we would never realize the benefits of it. So this is where sustainability is. It's people, profit, and planet. It's about trying to find the combination of these three factors towards that goal of being able to sustain for the long run.
So you talked about sort of that technology piece. Is it that the technology will become available? It's just that this complex ecosystem of regulations and is not going to be able to react fast enough? Or is it the technology we can't even envision what it would take to create a net zero aircraft?
No, I think we have a roadmap for how to get there. And what's, I think, fascinating is that before the pandemic, if I went to an aviation conference and if I was going to be speaking about the environmental impacts of the sector, I would be trying to get out of there after my talk as fast as possible so no one would come and get mad at me because people were quite threatened and people saw environmental impacts as threatening the economic viability of the sector. So there was a lot of friction there. But after the pandemic, I feel like the sort of collective hardship that the whole industry went through, and everyone suffered during the pandemic, but I think we can all understand aviation shut down. Like all of those careers really did come to a grinding halt. And something about that collective trauma evolved the culture of the industry. And so when the pandemic recovery happened, now what we see is every aviation conference has sustainability as a top line issue. It really did change the way everyone thinks about it. And we all recognized, it's not about today, it's about the long run. So the roadmaps for technologies for how we get there, there's been a lot of work in mapping those out. But the challenge is that aviation is just really a hard to decarbonize sector. And that's a huge challenge. So for example, the institute that I run, we through research funds, we did bring two fully electric aircraft that are at our local airport. And we're bringing them in cooperation with the Waterloo Wellington Flight Center and Transport Canada, as well as university researchers, to try to figure out how these, very low to no emission aircraft could be used in training. But the limitation of electric aviation is that it's very, very short range. Mm. So you're talking like less than an hour, which dramatically limits, how it can be used in training. Also, the limited availability of chargers. So there's, electric propulsion. And a big challenge with that is batteries are heavy. Mm. And in aviation, the more weight you have, the more power you need to balance it out. Then we look at hydrogen propulsion, and hydrogen has significant promise. There's a lot of researchers exploring that, but the problem with hydrogen is its volume. It's big relative to traditional fuels. So we expect, and Airbus is a real leader in this space, we expect in 20 years, we will see hydrogen propulsion that's flying people over the ocean. We also have some hybrid technologies that are coming into play. But really, I think the top line thing people are investing in is what we call sustainable aviation fuels, or SAF. And this is sort of traditional aviation fuels that are part of the active carbon cycle. So we're not drilling into the ground and pulling them out of the ground, but we're using things that are already part of society to create these sustainable fuels. But the challenge is there's very limited availability, and the cost of these fuels is very, very high, which is a huge challenge because fuel is already the biggest cost for air operations. So when you take normal fuel, and if sustainable fuel is 3 to 5 to 7 times as expensive, then you bring this back to the economic impacts. Would your friends as passengers be willing to pay 5 to 7 times as much for an airline ticket if it is not producing the emissions? And I think a lot of people would say no. And that's a huge challenge. And the other part is that there's new research suggesting that with all of the focus on emissions, and the industry collectively is working towards net zero emissions by 2050. So that's the international target everyone's working towards. But newer research is suggesting that contrails, if you look up in the sky and you see these, you know, long clouds forming behind airplanes in flight, new research is suggesting that contrails have more warming properties from aviation than the emissions that are produced. So that's a dramatic finding. Like that leads to all sorts of questions around, well, maybe we should change focus and we should put more emphasis on how we are flying the aircraft, because there's only certain atmospheric conditions where contrails can form. So should instead we be putting our emphasis on air traffic optimization and routing these aircraft around those atmospheric conditions? But it's a rapidly evolving area. And as again, going back to the beginning, as a global community, we may need to recognize that aviation is one of the hardest to decarbonize sectors. And it may be something that as a society in the future, we recognize that it may be easier for us to offset by reducing emissions in other sectors to allow aviation to continue. But it's an evolving conversation.
Yeah, it is interesting. There's so much there that struck me. The one thing about the collective trauma of what COVID did to the industry, because I've talked to a lot of people who are now questioning, you know, a second career or a third career or maybe their final career. And it does trace back to COVID and how that was a global event that sort of woke people up out of their autopilot, for lack of a better term, right? Like I never thought about, I've talked to people about how they've done that and how it's affected them personally, because in the absence of that, they'd probably be working in the same job that they had been before. But I hadn't considered that it could happen on an industry-wide basis and how that trauma could kind of knock an entire industry or at least open its eyes to things that probably they wouldn't be focusing on.
Yeah, I think it also reinforced to society how human it is to have the desire to be mobile and to travel and to have actual experiences. Like I think before COVID, if you had mentioned to anyone, like, can you imagine we're going to spend a year and a half, like for me in my basement, like working from home. And as much as I love board games with my family, it does ignite this sort of desire to travel and to see the world and to have experiences. And that's one of the sort of these social impacts of aviation as well, that I think, you know, we saw after the pandemic this huge resurgence in interest in travel. People wanted to be with other human beings and they wanted to have new experiences and see the world. And this is where sort of this balance is with sustainability. It's that we want to support people, we want to support sustainable tourism, we want to support the economic viability of people, jobs, and all of those economic impacts that drive so much in our world, but how can we do that responsibly from an environmental perspective? And it's not an easy balance. So for example, I went to a conference last year and I was giving a keynote address talking about some of this work. It was an airline conference. And after I spoke, a gentleman came up and he was from Mauritius, which is a small island nation. And he said that, well, I love the environment and these different initiatives, and we're, you know, obviously very supportive of that. He said, as a small island nation where a large percentage of our GDP is dependent on tourism, that we, you know, of course, it's very challenging to say we want to support potentially reducing airfares, or we want to, not airfares, but the amount of air flights that are serving their nation, because that's going to directly affect their economy. So things that I don't think people would ever intend, like if we're saying we want to, you know, add additional taxes to air flights to invest in offsets, or we want to do some demand management and limit air travel because we want to reduce the emissions. Like all of these things that I think are done by passionate people who want to do good in the world, and they see the negative impacts, environmental impacts of the industry. But it's so multidimensional and it's so complicated, and you don't realize that potentially that action leads to an unintended consequence that could be very detrimental to, in this case, a whole nation mm-hmm. who has very strong ties and dependencies on aviation to support their economy.
You mentioned contrails. I want to come back to that. So why do they have a bigger impact? And I guess the second part is that would addressing that help us hit the 2050 target, or is it something completely different?
It's different. So net zero by 2050 is the target for international aviation, and that's very much about carbon emissions. So net zero meaning we do everything we can to reduce the emissions at the source using things like sustainable fuels, electric hydrogen propulsion in the future, and flying as efficiently. So, you know, the most direct path between point A and point B burns less fuel. And so we reduce emissions as much as we can. And then anything that's left over, then we would invest in offsets. So we would sort of use some of those funds to support initiatives in other sectors that balance out those emissions. So it comes to net zero. That's the target. But the contrails are sort of another category of activities. We call it like non-CO2 impacts. And it's very challenging because, as I mentioned, you know, it's balanced between the most direct flight path. Sometimes the most direct path between point A and point B will have an aircraft flying through atmospheric conditions that are going to be producing contrails. But we don't yet know as a sector the balance between, well, if I have to burn more fuel to go around that section of the atmosphere, is that a net positive or a net negative? and that balance, because potentially, you know, you could say, never fly in the atmosphere that is going to produce contrails, but then maybe that adds a significant amount of time and that's producing a lot more fuel burn and a lot more emissions. So it's not something we have the direct answer to right now, but we do believe that the future of sort of the environmental sustainability for aviation can't be achieved by one thing. So it's not just sustainable fuels. It's not just electrification, hydrogen offsets. It's everything. So it's sort of like I often describe sustainability as a mosaic. It's almost like 1,000 points of light, and we need to sort of have everybody moving all at the same time. And there's not one solution. It's many, many, many solutions led by people who are passionate about that vision of the future and trying to retain the good without sacrificing everything we can to reduce and eliminate the harm.
So net zero by 2050, and given the complexity of the challenge before us, suggests, I think, a level of global cooperation that leaves me very skeptical. How do you feel about that 2050 target? And if you miss it, what's going to be the reason?
Some would argue that we are not on target to achieve that goal. It's very challenging. Airlines may invest in a new airplane, and that airplane may have a lifespan of 20 to 30 years, and that's today's technology. So when you start looking ahead to 2050, you're like, well, we're still probably going to be flying some of these planes in 2050. So that's where sustainable aviation fuel is very attractive, because you could drop it in to today's technology. It's a problem without a good solution, but I'm so inspired by all the new ideas that are coming forward. Like it really is sort of pre-pandemic, this aviation sustainability sector was very small, and we didn't have, you know, there wasn't a lot of visibility. But today, like, we're seeing these like all sorts of startups and new ideas and innovations. And where we met at the Accelerator Center is a really good example of that in our region, where they were looking at supporting startups who are linked to sustainable aviation. And this is a quick example. If anyone is curious, you can Google Advanced Air Mobility, or AAM. And Advanced Air Mobility is kind of like this Jetsons era concept, where cities of the future will have electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. We call them EVTOLs, electric vertical takeoff and landing. And these aircraft, we can imagine like calling an Uber, and a car picks you up at home, takes you to a vertiport, and there is one of these little aircraft waiting for you. You get in it and it flies you to the other side of the city. And when you get off, there's another Uber waiting for you to take you to your final destination. So there's a lot of really exciting movement in this space, and it is completely sort of deconstructing traditional views of aviation because it is sort of taking some drone technology and, you know, AI and all these different new technological innovations that will allow for these vehicles to revolutionize what it means to move around within a city in the future.
That is really cool. Where do you think those things will be commercialized first?
Well, we're seeing in the Middle East, we're seeing some leadership there that they seem to be first movers in adopting some of that. But, you know, there's a lot even locally. So Horizon Aircraft is an Ontario-based company, and they're creating some really interesting prototypes. So we're seeing Uber has actually invested in one of these companies. And so they're imagining, you know, fully integrating eVTOLs with ground-based transportation. And it really is I would call it a multimodal future. The reality is that, you know, we look at a sustainable future, we should be using each mode of transportation where it makes the most sense, right? Like it probably doesn't make a lot of sense for us to be flying very short distances when rail-based transportation could be much more environmentally efficient and have the speed and the efficiency as well. So I think the future is very multimodal, and eVTOLs and sort of this advanced air mobility is really sort of rethinking how air can be integrated into in-city transportation. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, is it ever? I must admit, I'm sure I was promised jetpacks by now. I'm a little discouraged that in 2025, we're still not flying around with jetpacks. I'm sure that was part of the plan.
Yeah. Although if I've seen people with jetpacks, they don't seem super maneuverable. So I think maybe
they don't seem to be loving it much as I thought.
maybe it's good we don't have a whole bunch of people just all over the world. I feel like there may be some accidental situations that wouldn't be a good outcome on that. But I think that, you know, that's where I sit. So University of Waterloo has Canada's largest pilot training degree program. So we take in 120 student pilots each year. And that's been the real fuel behind a lot of the research that we do. So in 2021, I founded the Waterloo Institute for Sustainable Aeronautics, or WISA. It's a research institute embedded in the university. And if you can imagine what's possible if we have hundreds of student pilots on campus who can support as research participants in one of the leading research universities in Canada, if not internationally, you can imagine what's possible. And, you know, we have researchers who are touching everything else we've spoken about, you know, electric propulsion and hydrogen and you know, how do you integrate electric planes into training and all sorts of different things. We have now more than 150 professors who have joined as part of the institute. And they're all sort of using their creativity and innovation and imagination to think like how my research expertise links into this problem. And it goes back to that sort of mosaic concept that we will never achieve sustainable aviation with just one person or one idea or one technology. It needs everything. It's a movement happening all at the same time.
I'm glad you mentioned the Institute because it does feel like we started this conversation, or at least I came into this conversation expecting to hear that this was kind of hopeless, that, you know, we're just going to keep burning fuel and we'll find a way to save the planet and other industries. It's not going to happen in aviation. It's too big a problem. It does sound like there's been tremendous progress and we're moving in the right direction. There is hope.
I think there's hope, but I'm a diehard optimist. And so I feel like, you know, with this much passion and excitement and innovation, all of this coming together, I think that's what you need to do something positive in the world. And Waterloo is really special in that sense. Like we have a lot of pieces here in our region that make us really unique. And that's just one city of, you can imagine how many around the world. So I think there's reason for us to be optimistic, but it's also, like I said, there's more questions than answers. But when you have, I think, all of that passion and excitement moving in that direction, I am optimistic about the future.
One question that I've got, and I'd love to get your perspective on this. So when you started, you talked about just, it seems like aviation is the only thing you've ever really wanted to do, flight school at 15 and your first solo at 16, et cetera. when I hear that story, it sounds like somebody that's just found something they love to do early on in their life, and they just never wanted to do anything else. And it seems like a bit of a dream that you would find this passion in a world of people that are kind of, you know, maybe my age, or like, you know, I'm still trying to find my purpose. What am I going to do with my life? And you seem to have found it and never wavered, but I have a feeling maybe it's not that simple. So what don't I get about that journey?
I think that any journey probably has more failures than successes, more pivots than what you expect. And, you know, I'm a person who works a lot with 17, 18, 19-year-old young people, and often reflect that it's crazy to think that we ask people at that age to make decisions that impact the rest of their lives, because people change and evolve so much. And I would say today that while aviation is the core, that I see myself as a teacher. I think that's the skill set. That's the passion that I never expected when I was a teenager. But being able to work with people who share that passion and to help them have a future and avoid challenges that you've experienced, and like that I feel is something that I would have never anticipated. But I feel like it's who I am and what I'm meant to do. I can joke that, like, when I started teaching when I was 24, you know, I remember being sick to my stomach before every lecture. Like, I was terrified. I remember, like, sweating through my clothes. Like, it was, you know, I was scared. And it took, like, years. And then I remember the very first time I taught a 3-hour lecture, and everyone's eyes were up the whole time. Like, I had their attention the whole lecture. And I remember driving home and calling my family. I'm like, you won't believe what happened today. Like, I had their attention the whole time. And it was this huge, it was like a hard-earned kind of epiphany of like that feeling is so, so fulfilling. Like, you feel like I've communicated and I've supported these people in a way that hopefully is valuable to them. I tell my students, put your heart and soul into where you are today. But the reality is that you never know what the future is going to hold. And you probably will have to pivot, and you'll probably encounter barriers and obstacles and all sorts of challenges that you can't expect now. But if you keep working and you keep moving and you keep pivoting instead of giving up or letting go, like, you never know where you'll end up, but you'll probably feel like you're where you're supposed to be.
Wow, that's beautiful. I love that. And I know exactly how your students felt when you were delivering your first ever 3-hour lecture and all eyes were on you, because that's exactly the feeling I had watching you talk about all of this when we met. And God, it's just been such an enlightening and thoughtful conversation. And I really look forward to reflecting on it, because you've just opened my eyes to a dozen things that I know I knew nothing about, and now I know 1% about, if that makes any sense.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Can I ask you one last question? Mm-hmm. When you talk about helicopters, they seem like a ridiculously complicated way to get off the ground. And it's a wonder that these things, that we haven't come up with a better idea by now. Yeah. What would surprise people to know about helicopters?
Helicopters are, I would describe them personally as significantly more complicated to fly than an airplane. So in an airplane, you know, you take off and land, and statistically the takeoffs and the landings are the highest risk, you know, portions of the flight. And then a lot of the time, you know, once you're in a cruise portion in a fixed wing flight, you can trim it up in a way where you could, you know, take your hands off the controls, and, you know, you're still working, you're taking notes, you're doing different things. But helicopters, your both hands and both feet are all working all of the time. And it's a coordinated process where, you know, I still can't talk about it without putting my hands in those positions. And like, you know, like, because it's almost like you can't verbally articulate it, that you sort of need the that psychomotor muscle memory to, in order to tell a story or to explain what's happening. But the world's changing. And what has really changed is integrating a lot of that drone-based technology. That's where that question becomes, well, will they fly more like a helicopter, more like an airplane? Or is it going to be very automated? And we're looking at maybe self-flying eVTOLs in the future, autonomous. And there's all different kinds. So some eVTOLs are planned to be autonomous. Some are piloted. That being said, while helicopters, I would say, are harder to fly, they teach you sort of this dynamic between speed and altitude. There's almost nothing that, you know, the trade-off between the two that teaches you as well as flying a helicopter. And I would argue that there's nothing like the sense of freedom when you're flying in a helicopter that you could go anywhere. So when I was 16, I flew a helicopter and I landed it on my grandparents' front lawn. It was funny because then there was some media there, and the media, I thought it was like the coolest thing, because I like helicopters are amazing. But the media did an interview, and the commentators were talking afterwards, and they're like, imagine that, flying helicopters and still wearing braces. And I was like, oh, not so cool. but it's, you know, I guess my advice to people is that, you know, hard things can be really fun. If you follow your passion, you know, it's amazing what, you know, is a chore, but can feel like some very fulfilling and exciting.
There, I could talk about this for hours. I have so many questions. You've been amazing, and I've absolutely loved every minute of this. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.